This is CIUT 89.5 FM, the University of Toronto Community Radio Station. Available across Canada on Star Choice National Satellite Service Channel 826 and broadcasting worldwide at www.ciut.fm.
Thank you, CIUT supporters, for your generous contributions during our Spring Friends of 89.5 membership drive. Your support means everything to us, and to show you our thanks, with the help of our sponsors, we have some great grand prizes for our grand prize draws. All you have to do is get your pledges paid by May 29th, and you'll be entered into the draws to win a Norco Scorcher bike, courtesy of Bikes on Wheels, a one-year membership to Hard House Athletics, an arts and culture prize pack that includes a pair of tickets to see Pink Martini at Massey Hall, dinner for two with Southern Accent, VIP passes to the Bloor Cinema, and more. Don't procrastinate. Get your pledge in today. For more info, go to www.ciut.fm.
Do you ever make up a dance and stomp your feet or punch an old pillow? Or do you have a loud song that you can sing when you're angry? Here's some loud music, which just sounds like it's saying, I'm angry. I'm very, very angry.
Good evening and welcome to CIUT 89.5 FM. You're tuned to Equalizing the Store, the weekly hardcore punk show. We started off tonight's show with Back Off Baby by Tyranna, taken from the No Pedestrian comp that was released by Chameleon Street quite a few years back in 1980, I think, maybe. And Tyranna were considered a second wave punk band from Toronto, although that's kind of debatable because Toronto were sort of one of the first of the genuine punk bands trying to be punk, unlike their predecessors who were toughening up their rock image to fit in with the punk scene. Being the brainchild of Rabies, who was a woman who defied gender role types and was a true shit disturber in the sense of the word, to be modeled after, Tyranna would go on to record and play out and push all sorts of boundaries. We spoke to the members, some of the members this afternoon about Tyranna, and tonight's show is all about their story. So here goes. We're going to start off with the interview and parts thereof mixed with a bunch of songs, different live and rare tracks that we've got by Tarana. And we're going to squeeze in some of a Studio 3 session that we recorded back in the fall of last year. Here we go. Hi, welcome to the show. Introduce yourselves and tell us what you do in the band. Maybe Cleve, if you could start.
Yeah, I'm Cleve Anderson, the drummer.
I'm Johnny Bubblegum in terms of the interview here, bass player and last founding member involved here today.
Okay, Ron?
Okay, Ronnie Partridge, guitar.
Okay, and how did you guys get into punk?
I had a subscription to Rolling Stone magazine. I remember reading about something going on in New York City about a bunch of bands playing at CBGB's. This was probably 75. That sounded really interesting because I was always interested in rock and roll and how the history of it was unfolding, and I always wanted to be part of something new. So I took a little trip down and went to Max's Kansas City, which was also the other little hotbed for new music, you know, with an artier bent, and CBGB's, I think it was 75 in the fall. And when I came back to Toronto, I was just sort of hoping something similar might happen. So when I started to see the posters on Yonge Street, I saw a poster for The Dishes on a post on Yonge Street. It's about to be a household word or a household name. And this sounded like fun, interesting. It was all do-it-yourself. And so I went and saw them at the Beverly Tavern and just sort of hooked in, you know, and kept watching for those posters. And I think, you know, I, being a little bit older than most of the people in the punk scene, I'd already had a little taste of the garage rock thing. And when that kind of, it was sort of a short-lived moment around 65, 66, and I always felt like I was never really finished with that kind of excitement, that kind of raw rock and roll energy. So it almost seemed like, you know, this was a way of kind of reconnecting and moving on into the future with something that I thought had been neglected.
Okay. Jerry.
Yeah, I was.
What was your experience?
I was a little later, of course, and same kind of thing. Seeing stuff in Rolling Stone and rock scene, different papers coming out of New York, and CFMY, as it was known then, Edge 102, as it is now in Brampton, actually was good back then and played. They played some early stuff, and that's probably me and my friend Doug probably heard the Sex Pistols the first time. And I had a brother who worked in Hamilton. I sent him to Star Records to pick up a French pressing of Anarchy in the UK for me. And first time I put that on, that was it. And well, I guess before that I'd heard the Ramones, and it had already, Dee Dee's down-picking style had already affected the way I played bass. But it was really when I heard the Sex Pistols the first time that it was like, got to start a band and get into it from there. And so that's late or early 77 maybe. And then luckily in the summer of 78 I got a call from John Ziegler to come to Toronto and join a band, and I was in from there.
Okay. Ron, what was your...
Well, for me, I guess I was the youngest guy in the band, and I was in grade 12, and like Jerry with CFNY introduced me to the Sex Pistols, and it just blew my mind because I didn't like anything I was hearing, like Ted Nugent, and there's this crap music that everyone was listening to. I couldn't understand it. I was listening to older stuff, like old Led Zeppelin and stuff, because I just couldn't stand the way it was going. And then this just like, it was just what I needed to hear, and I just went straight downhill from there, right into it. And next thing I auditioned for the Valtones, or going to Dead Boys shows, and Vera put an ad in the paper, and I replied, and these guys were already together, and I got involved with Tarana, and that was about it.
It seems to me that it's a pretty big step to go from like listening to music to already starting to play bands and stuff. It seems like people were taking quick steps really early on in the punk scene just to even make things happen. Were you guys mostly from Toronto? Well, Jerry, you were saying something about
Hamilton. Just to go
back into
what you were just saying about jumping in.
Yeah,
that
sure.
Was totally for me. Like, I'd got a bass in grade 9 and I played to records and learned some stuff, but I probably hadn't really played my bass, maybe even touched it in several weeks, and hadn't played it seriously in several months when I got the call from Ziegler, but I'd done enough playing. So I got this call, I put on Teenage Heads, Tear Me Apart, and got my fingers going again, and, you know, two rehearsals later, Tarana was gigging.
Yeah, yeah.
Or two rehearsals later, we had a band, and then we were gigging, and then we did a demo, and that's
a bit of a whirlwind.
Yeah, it was a real whirlwind, and yeah. that was such an exciting thing about punk to have it happen that fast.
Yeah,
but I was out in Burlington in my teens. I was originally born up in Meaford and moved around a bit. But
oh, you were from Meaford?
Yeah, Meaford, Ontario, and I was out in Burlington when I got it, and that put me closer to Hamilton. So I actually saw Teenage Head. They were my first live punk experiences.
You're local.
And that was before their 45 came out. Some of the early shows at Kilroy's Tavern and M.M. Robinson in high school in Burlington. So I caught the Hamilton scene before getting into the Toronto scene.
Okay, well, this is my next question, is what were some of the first shows that you would have seen while getting into the scene? So you were mentioning Teenage Head. What about the rest of you?
Well,
Cleve already mentioned the Dishes, but you can expand on.
Yeah, well, I'll go back to the garage rock thing, seeing the Ugly Ducklings in grade 10, which was, I guess, 65 or 66 was, you know, a little kind of, I'll just throw that in. But I did go to that first Ramones show that the Garys did at the New Yorker Theater. It was Gary told me it was September 76. I thought it was October, but he should know. But so, not to split hairs, but that show was like a turning point, and that was kind of an introduction for me.
Okay.
In many ways. And I did go to Crash and Burn, started after that. I was at the Crash and Burn for a couple of those shows. I saw the Dead Boys there, and Teenage Head, Diodes. So that's kind of some of my shows, beginnings.
Yeah, yeah. Ron?
Well, yeah. For me, because I was younger, I was still in high school. Though, the Horseshoe, like, I missed so much. The Crash and Burn, all that was before I was really introduced to the music. So
yeah.
I caught on a little later. And so the Horseshoe, and then it was the turning point for me. And that, I missed a good start of the wave, unfortunately, but that was my first.
Yeah, and the Beverly Tavern was going that.
Oh,
just
yeah, and
a
the
step back
to,
you know, for me was kind of paralleled. It was even before Crash and Burn. That's where I saw the Dishes and Battered Wives. The original version of the band, which I ended up joining, was a trio that I saw there, and Martha the Muffins, Johnny the G-Rays,
the Verbs, and again, yeah, that's before my time seeing those bands, but. Hearing a lot about it. I had friends who were coming in to do that and going to David's, and but I just, I don't know, didn't get in.
Okay.
I was doing the Head.
Same
time.
Yeah, a lot of people wish they were, too.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. So it's kind of the same period.
I'm sure that people have envy of your experience, nonetheless. You guys were alluding to a bit about how the band starting to form. So what's the story? How did the band actually form? How did Tyranna come together?
Well, I'll get that since I was the earlier one of the us three in the band. But I never really got the story of how Ziegler and Vera met up, but I imagine just at one of the clubs. And so they started doing some rehearsals and songwriting, I believe, just in early 78.
Was he the original guitarist? Or?
Yeah, he was the original guitarist. It started with...
And Vera was the singer?
Yeah, Vera was the singer, Rabies. She'd had a band performing around... Don Pyle couldn't even come up with the name, and he saw them in photograph. It's in here?
Yeah.
Check it out, Ron. See if
you
can find it. So she was doing some gigs around town. I'm not sure if it was in the clubs or if it was just outdoor events. But I guess then she... and Tony Brighton from The Ugly was in that band. The later Ugly was in that band with Vera. But her and Ziegler got together, started writing some songs. The ones that continued into the band were Unfaithful, Divorce, the linked songs, and also Shock Face. And I imagine it wouldn't have been too long after they started that John called me. And I came in from Burlington. This is mid-June.
How did they know you?
John was a friend of a friend in Burlington. And we had a rehearsal once. Trying to put a band together in, you know, some kid's basement. And I remember the whole afternoon was spent trying to do Paranoid, and the one time we got three verses into, or, you know, three bars into it, and it was sounding good, John stopped playing to say how good it was sounding, and that was the most we got done the whole day. And on the strength of that, he called me up to join a band in Toronto. So I, as I said, picked up my bass, kind of got familiar with it again, came in, did two rehearsals with John and Vera, but all of us playing and singing through one 12-inch combo amp. And the third time I came in, John met me at the subway, told me we had a new guitarist. I thought that was great. We had another drummer. Well, there's two guitarists now and a drummer. And gigs Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. This was a Sunday.
Oh, wow.
And we had gigs Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
So that was like the third week of being together? Or?
Yeah. And not even a full rehearsal till the Sunday.
So Tyranno was actually a five-piece at one point.
Yes, for the first three gigs.
Okay.
And then it's amazing how fast it changed in the beginning. So we had Dave Porter on drums, John Tucker on guitar. He had the clean Telecaster sound, and then Johnny Ziegler with his Les Paul Gold Top, which he had dug out a hole himself with a drill
and
a chisel to put in a third pickup in, which gave it a very distinct, totally fuzzed out sound that partly was because of guitar as much as the MXR pedal he used. But so we had that five piece band. We wrote Johnny, I started that song. We wrote that one in between the Sunday rehearsal and the gig that week. Ronnie just showed me Queenie. I thought the band was called Queenie and Don. Didn't think it was, but that was the band that Vera had before.
Before Tyranno.
Before Tyranno. 77, 78, it says here in their little press king. So, John Tucker, Dave Porter, me, and Ziegler, and Rabies got together on the Sunday, did one rehearsal that day, rehearsed each of the next nights just in the evening, writing songs, covering songs, did the three gigs for the Ugly, and I believe...
How many songs did you think you had at that point?
It was six songs, I believe.
Okay.
Counting Unfaithful Divorce is one. Shock Face, Johnny, 12XU, the cover, I Want to Be Where the Boys Are, the cover. So six if you count Unfaithful Divorce is two, I should say.
Okay.
And then it's terrible to put words in the mouths of someone who's not here, but Mike Nightmare, I believe, did say we blew them off stage.
Oh, yeah?
The first night.
Oh, wow.
And I wouldn't say we did the next two nights, but...
They were ready for you then.
Yeah. I don't think they had any idea what was going to hit them that night.
Yeah.
And those were great gigs. And just the level of enthusiasm, because it happened so fast, was just huge. And I was in this whole new scene in the city, so I was just, on fire with excitement for the whole thing.
Yeah,
So we do the three gigs. We take Sunday off. I'd been wearing the same clothes all week, so I needed to go home and get changed. And we come back in on Monday. We start recording the first demo. And I guess Ziegler had it up his back that there was another guitarist now, even though the two guitar sound was amazing and very distinct. But I guess this got under his skin, and he showed up for the recordings of the original songs and then basically said he was going out for a coffee and never returned. So he doesn't actually even play on the two covers, 12XU and Where the Boys Are. And
who does?
Just so John Tucker, Dave Porter.
Yeah, okay, so just as a four-piece.
Yeah, just as a four-piece.
All right, here it is, and we're doing it, and it's called 12XU.
Cause it all man, yeah.
played two more gigs with The Curse in August and recorded one more demo with three songs, Unfaithful Divorce, Test Tube Babies, and a cover of Toronto Boys, as we called it, London Girls, the...
Yeah, the Vibrators cover.
Song.
Okay.
So that's the early days.
Okay. When did Tyrannus start? What was the... What do you think the date was? I heard something... We were talking about this, but I'm...
Like the
recall?
Very first one?
Yeah.
Well, that I believe that Dense Ugly gig was June... Ron's got the poster here.
June 78?
June 78. That's the wrong poster.
No, that's the first month.
That's the first of our collection. But it was June. The Ugly gigs were June, and like I say, it was really only a band several days before that, and I think it was the 4th and the 5th and the 6th. So very early June, and the band really only came together the week before that. So.
Okay. And how long was Tyranna around till?
The last Tyranna gig that I can see in the posters here, well, we did the E-Pop show, we had a gig at the Piccadilly Tube in November after the Iggy Pop show, November 79. Then we opened for Jane County at the Edge.
That was New Year's in 80.
Yeah, New Year's Eve 1980. And we played, I think, three or four nights that week at the Edge because they were recording the live album. And we supported them each night. And those were the final gigs. So it was like a year and a half.
A year and a half.
From beginning to end.
Yeah, okay.
And for this collective, that...
It's longer than I thought, then. Initially,
a little longer. Yeah. Everybody says a year, but it was a year and a half.
It was a year and a half.
It was a year for the band with Cleve and Ronnie. And
yeah, that was from the beginning of 79 till the end of 79.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Okay, so we were talking about the lineup change. I want to go back into that because I want to get to the introduction of Cleve and Ronnie into the band. So I guess we had left it at a four-piece after the one of the first recordings.
Mm-hmm.
How did the lineup? Was there other lineup changes?
No, just those ones.
Okay.
There was a woman who sat in guitar on the second gig at the Curse. I think Vera met her a couple days before and thought it'd be great to have another gal in the band.
Yeah, yeah.
And she had a real kind of Farrah Fawcett look, so it would have been really cool in with the punks. And she played one song at one of the Curse gigs, so that's a minor addendum to the lineups. But other than that, it was the two Curse gigs, that second demo that will be featured on the Rave Up record in September. And then that band collapsed, and... I think it was a month, that was August, so it was maybe October, Ronnie, that you met Vera?
That's really hard for me to think back to that. It was cold out.
I think it was after that, because I didn't meet Vera till the set. It was at the...
I have a note about February of 79.
That's first gig, probably.
That Cleve and Ronnie joined the band. That would have been the first gig.
Right.
I think I was already recruited, and we were looking for a good, you know, Vera. Well, we didn't have a complete band.
Cleve, you mentioned something about Vera approaching you at a Horseshoe gig in December.
It was the last Pogo.
The last
I'm
Pogo.
Sure it was.
December
1 and 2, I think. First and second was the last Pogo. And I'd been in Battered Wives. I'd done a year with Battered Wives and decided I wasn't going to be doing that anymore. And I went to the last Pogo and met Vera there. I was just watching the last Pogo film and seeing she shows up in a few of the scenes in it, you know. But
go ahead.
Yeah. So it was at the last Pogo that I met. I had seen Tyrann on one of the shows at the Turning Point. And I got to say, it was Johnny Bubblegum's bass playing. I thought, I like that. He's got the style down because, you know, there was a lot of thought at that time that, you know, what is punk rock? Is it a style or is it an attitude? And, you know, I think it was an attitude. But I was also interested that there was a new style of music emerging. You know, I thought that was pretty exciting. Like, you know, blues has certain characteristics and country and reggae. You know, and that punk rock had that this style of music was actually emerging. So I was looking for a band that had those ingredients that, you know, I could be part of that thing. So Tyrannus definitely was headed in a direction that was could be identified as punk rock.
Okay.
Yeah, to just expand on that a little bit, yeah, like That's one thing I always felt about the Turan is that we did play punk rock. We weren't just a bunch of old rockers who got together and kind of toughened it up and, you know, put on different clothes and called it punk rock. It was the elements that came together. Vera had a strong melody and but a very strong kind of vocal attack. And she was really confrontational at this point, like with the audience and with their ideas and songs. Incredibly striking woman. And then you got the two guitars. You got, as I mentioned before, John Ziegler with his completely fuzzed out kind of heavy metal fuzz sound, like a old heavy metal Black Sabbath. And then John Tucker was very angular. I'd never heard of anybody playing alternate tunings before. I'd pick up his Telecaster and tune it for him, and then he'd come in rage and he'd screwed up his guitar.
Oh, yeah.
I had no idea what was going on. And so he had this very angular style, and then the drummer was kind of loose but jazzy, but there was this blend of elements that you wouldn't think to put together, really. And I think that was very punk. And the choice of covers in that first week, Wire and Wire's 1-2-XU and Where the Boys Are, Venus and the Razor Blades, which we threw some really, you know, we didn't play it the way they did at all.
No, not at all.
I really feel Toronto was a band that was inventing something new, maybe not globally, but I think in Toronto we had a unique sound. We, at that first gig with the... And I said what Mike Nightmare said about us, but one of the guys, I think it was Muhammad from the Dents, he called us Sophisto Punk, which
right.
I took as a great compliment.
Right. Okay, well, I want to get into that in a sec. But first I want to ask.
Thank you, CIUT supporters, for your generous contributions during our Spring Friends of 89.5 membership drive. Your support means everything to us, and to show you our thanks, with the help of our sponsors, we have some great grand prizes for our grand prize draws. All you have to do is get your pledges paid by May 29th, and you'll be entered into the draws to win a Norco Scorcher bike, courtesy of Bikes on Wheels, a one-year membership to Hard House Athletics, an arts and culture prize pack that includes a pair of tickets to see Pink Martini at Massey Hall, dinner for two at Southern accent, VIP passes to the Bloor Cinema, and more. Don't procrastinate. Get your pledge in today. For more info, go to www.ciut.fm.
This is CIUT 89.5 FM, the University of Toronto community radio station. Available across Canada on Star Choice National Satellite Service, Channel 826, and broadcasting worldwide at www.ciut.fm.
About Ronnie, when Ronnie came into the band, did you come in around the last pogo, do you think it was? Because you were saying it was cold.
I think Cleve was already online with Vera.
So
they decided, you know, they were going to do this. And she put an ad in the newspaper, so I guess she didn't have anybody in mind. And we met, and the same night we wrote a few songs. And then Cleve came over, like, following day, and I kind of auditioned for him. We tried the songs we'd written, and he said, okay, let's try it. And then you were out of town at the time in Burlington,
yeah,
and so we had to wait until your schedule allowed you to come in. And we were rehearsing in this old house where Vera was living with her dad, and I don't know why they put up with us, but they did.
Yeah.
And that's where we did a lot of our rehearsing, was in that old house.
Mm-hmm.
And it just went from there. And we wrote songs together. Cleve wrote songs on his own and brought them in, and we just did them pretty much as he brought them in, and just made them our own style a little bit. But
and Jer too, yeah.
And Jer, yeah, as well. That's right. Sorry,
Cleve coming in really, with his, he had way more experience, and the solidity of Cleve's drumming, let alone the energy, really took the, you know, gelled the band. Like, it was a much tighter, stronger outfit once Cleve came in, and yeah, just bringing discipline into rehearsing and playing. And
yeah, well, he had the experience, and, like, you know, if we were wasting too much time in between song, he'd get us going on to the next song, or he's saying, you know, hey, let's run over that one last bit of it, where, you know, nothing was, everything stayed together tight, and we didn't waste much time. And
yeah, you know, if there was a part that was loose, you know, maybe Cleve would have us go over that a few times, yeah, just that part. And
just to nail it, you know.
Really tightened us up, and
yeah,
great songs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had the whip out.
that's what I get. Was that rehearsal place, was that out in the West End?
Yeah, Jane and Dundas, pretty much.
Jane and St. John.
St. John's.
Road, yeah.
For me, well, my car was hit and miss. Sometimes it would start, sometimes it wouldn't.
Okay.
And I was out in Scarborough.
Oh, that's a long way to go.
The very east end of Scarborough. Yeah, yeah. And I got into a lot of fights. I got beat up a lot because I wasn't a very good fighter. And, but I never lost my Les Paul, which is amazing because it was brand new when I got it. And it took a lot of beatings. And but no one ever got that handle out of my hand, no matter how hard they tried, because I wasn't going to let go of it.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing. To go a little off topic, is at the time, it was very violent,
mm-hmm,
to walk around. Like, because Vera and I, after I left Scarborough and pretty much stayed in the West End, like, we lived the way we looked. We didn't just, like, oh, let's go dress up and go do a punk show.
Yeah.
We, like, walked around like that all the time, because we were really, it was the way to... It's just the way we did it. It seemed like the right thing to do. But unfortunately, there's a lot of people out there when my car wasn't running, and we'd be on the TTC going from West End, East End rehearsals, and we ran into a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Like, because we looked a little different.
Particularly
and
rockers.
We didn't want to take any shit from anybody, mm-hmm, at the, yeah, same time.
Yeah, for sure.
Because the music kind of led you to feel a little bit more angry about things.
Yeah.
And intolerance and things. And
yeah, it usually led to confrontation, I'm sure. Yeah, on the street. I remember, yeah, that happening with the rockers, just like,
but
you becoming the target.
Yeah, so but anyway, so we were in the West End pretty much, to your question, at St. John and Jane was where we rehearsed mostly.
Okay. And were you still living in Burlington?
Yeah, at
you
that point.
Commuting from Burlington back and,
yeah,
forth.
Yeah,
so that's also a huge commute.
Yeah, and I didn't do it enough, you know. Like, I realize now I could have added a lot more to the band in that time, like, been in writing songs with Vera, but I just kind of left it her to get the band back together after the collapse of the first one. But I think it really happened fast after that, and It's not like I had a hell of a lot going on out in Burlington to keep me busy out there. I just was a lazy kid, I guess, and didn't want to get his ass into the city until the guys said, look, you know, you got it.
Yeah.
You got to get in here so we can be a band and rehearse often. And I think I was still living in Burlington when we got the call from the Garys to open for the Dills. Because whoever was supposed to open that show canceled out at the very last minute. And so you know, that was when you realize how fast things could happen. That was kind of my call to get into the city and be there.
But I think it worked well for us. I'll just interject this, that Ron and Rabies or Vera wrote songs together. And then there was a sort of smattering of your songs and mine too. So it kind of...
It all blended.
Yeah, blended good.
Yeah. Okay. And Test Tube Babies, which came from the four-piece version of the first version of the band, get convoluted, that was a song that was written just for the second demo and the Curse gigs. And, you know, Vera wrote most of the song, but then she said, you know, I need something a little more poppy and high energy for this section. And so she brought that to me, you know, give me a bass part for this. And there was maybe a little more interaction between Vera and I in the first band before Ronnie came in, and then they were a really strong songwriting team.
Right, okay.
And so I don't think there was too much interaction with the songwriting.
No.
Other than, you know, we'd all bring our parts in. And
well, maybe she had already figured out she'd worked it out with you, and Ronnie was newer, so.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well.
Yeah, it's not a negative thing.
No, that's not what I'm thinking at all.
Well, usually I'd just be, like, so I was living in the house with her and her dad at that point, when I left Scarborough, and so I'd just be banging away, making noise, and she'd say, play that one again, and then she'd
probably
say,
had a lot
yeah,
more time
keep that one, and she'd get her little cassette machine going, and she'd sing something to it, and she did all the lyrics, like, she might ask me for a rhyme to a line at the most, but it was all the lyrics for her, to my knowledge, were hers. Mm-hmm. And I just provided the background.
Mm. Right, right.
I'm confused. Too many faces, too many names, too many places, too many games, too many problems that aren't about you. Too much to think of and I'm mixed up too. I'm confused. Getting pushed this way, getting pulled there. My feet won't work and my head's not clear. My brain's clogged up and my body's pulled down. Too much to think of and I'm spinning around. I'm confused. Says it's a monstrous thing. She's gonna be Gavilek or something. The world shed all perfect children. Guaranteed free of genetic defects. We should all be perfectly smart. No more morons, goose and shirts. Touch your babies. I want you to have eyes of blue. I want you to be my guest too, baby. I'm gonna go see my doctor today. I'm gonna help build up the barrage. They pick one and throw the rest away. I thank God for this miracle. No more problems in the world. Perfect boys and perfect girls. That's your babies. babies. That's your babies. That's your babies. That's your babies. That's your babies. Want you to have eyes of blue. I want you to be just like my neighbor. Like my neighbor. Everybody, everybody, touch the baby, touch the baby, touch the baby. I heard the laboratories made a mistake. The next generation is at stake. Well, we gotta wait till the babies come out. They were exposed while being shipped. You thought that they were making underground strange energy frequencies of sound. Yeah, we gotta wait. Yeah, we gotta wait. 'Cause they made a mistake. So we gotta wait. Touch your babies, touch your babies, touch your babies, touch your babies. Want you to have eyes of blue. I want you to be my guest too, baby, now.
Okay, I was going to ask about the name Tyranna. Where did that come from? At first I thought it was a bastardization of the name Toronto.
A lot of people seem to think that.
That's what I thought. Fitting, right? That's what you thought.
That's what I thought. What Vera told me, she asked either her mother or
her
father
her mother, yeah.
What would be a good name for the band, and they said Tyranna.
She was the dominant. She wanted to be the dominant front person. She was like a tall woman, and she wanted to come across like leading a gang of guys. So she wanted to sound tyrannical and feminine at the same time. Hence Tyranna.
And it's only since Google's been around. And you put Tyranny and see what you're going to find, that I realize there is this mythological figure or legendary figure coming out of the Russian tradition.
Oh, is that right?
Called Tyranna. Vera's parents were Russian, so that might have been behind it as well.
When she's talking about,
I want a name for this strong female personality, that may be as well why they threw out Tyranna, because...
Yeah.
It existed in their culture.
Right, right.
So that's something I only found out more recently.
The sound. What was the idea behind the band when getting the band together, in terms of a sound?
I don't think we sat down and thought about it.
Just a punk band, mostly.
Yeah, we all had our influences, and they gelled. I mean, the first band happened so fast, there was no time for philosophizing. It was just...
Okay, well, you mentioned something about the Dents calling you sophisticado punk. What did they mean by that? What were they getting at?
I think it was the angularity and... I'm not saying to say time changes in the songs, but lots of stops and starts, rather intelligent lyrics, I would always felt. And
what convinced me to, other than having seen the band, and then she took me into the studio and played the demos, and I thought they were clever, and the lyrics were interesting, and I think the influences. I think XTC had been really early. XTC was an influence. I think someone had mentioned when I was there, and that that's comes from an arty kind of background, but it was still.
But Andrew Partridge was considered an intelligent guy in the punk scene.
Yeah,
the singer from XTC.
Right.
He didn't. They had XTC had a certain air about them.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. Okay. We mentioned the first gig, which was, I think, with The Ugly. You played 4 days with The Ugly at the Turning Point?
3 days.
3 days? And the Dents and Arson and the Existers, is that correct?
Existers, I think, came into one of those nights. I don't remember Arson being around on those ones. It's possible. I think gigs were pretty fluid there, where all the band members of a band were at the show and...
They might jump on the stage.
Yeah, everybody was agreeable. I mean, that's how the Vileones got into Last Pogo, too, right?
Yeah, right.
And that's how the Ugly, I hear, got... Nobody wanted to invite them to gigs because they'd get blown off stage with the Ugly, I guess, in the early days. But they
So they just show up.
They jump on stage. So maybe it was pretty acceptable because, for sure, people played those gigs, those first couple of gigs that weren't on weren't on the list.
I think there's a flyer for that where Veer is coming out of like a, it looks like a Toronto Toronto Star, like there's some Toronto Star stuff.
Yeah, that's when.
Is there a reference to something in the Toronto Star?
No, outside of me being a paperboy when I was a kid.
Oh, okay.
That was just, those photos came out of, you know, Don Pyle was in the same neighborhood. He knew Vera before any of us, and just like he'd show up at our rehearsals all throughout the band, he did these great photo sessions with us at our second rehearsal, kind of things, of why we have such great documentation. And that's all it was. We were just goofing around the streets. And
okay.
But it's
yeah,
it's
birds
shot.
In a feather fly. You know, it's just like the, he was a local guy in the West End around. Wasn't the high school right around the corner? Was that Runnymede Collegiate? That
could be. Yeah.
That did he go there?
Yeah, he did. He was talking about that in his interview. Yeah.
So yeah, I remember we had our little ride. We would be rehearsing. We'd go around to a little corner store, and there'd be the high school kids, and there'd be, you know, there'd be the confrontation. You know.
There, I think one of your second shows, well, in May, it looks like you were doing simultaneous shows in the same night. You were doing two gigs a night. There was some shows with Forgotten Rebels, and then at the Turning Point, and then there, you guys were also playing at Larry's Hideaway with Johnny and the G-Rays.
Yeah, Cleve Everett.
How did this get?
I think the Rebels gig would have been set up with a good amount of time to it. Like, we had that four-night gig with the Rebels. And
was that our what was our first gig? Do you remember?
The first, yeah, the first one? Gig was, here we are, Ron's got the poster.
February 1st.
1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th with the Dents. That's the second time with the Dents. And that's the Turning Point. So that's the
Turning Point, okay, the first, yeah.
The first gig with Cleve and Ron.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And
that's the second lineup.
Then we had the gig with the Forgotten Rebels, again at the Turning Point. And this is kind of surprising me that this gig is May. 3rd, 4th, 5th. I'm surprised that there's not, doesn't seem to be any indication of us playing between those.
Well, it's a little slow getting going, maybe.
Yeah, and then here we have, we were at one of those nights.
Larry's
we were also
Hideaway.
At Larry's Hideaway on the the Saturday night with the G-Rays.
We opened for the G-Rays and then went right over to the Turning Point. And I think
how did you,
Forgotten Rebels opened for us, I'm assuming.
Yeah, we traded nights.
Sometimes, yeah, we were... You know, we were just as big as Forgotten Rebels, weren't we?
In Toronto, yeah, probably. Yeah. Like that gig was when they put out their first EP, so they probably been known in Hamilton, yeah. But probably weren't that well known in Toronto yet. Though they got well known there because the CRTC immediately banned three of the four songs on the EP.
Yeah, tell us about this. There's a story that goes along with this.
Yeah,
isn't
that's a good story
about a gang.
Yeah, so the Rebels put out the EP.
Spearhead, I think.
And CRTC immediately banned it, and Third Homosexual Murder was on there. And an alleged gang called the Spearheads called the club up early in the week and said, if the band plays that song on Saturday night, we're taking Mickey out. So the club called Rabies and told her all about it, and Rabies decided to call down the Bleak Street Boys just to be around to make sure things were okay on Saturday night. And the Bleak Street Boys, who were the Vile Tones entourage, showed up looking for a fight, and of course the Spearheads never showed.
Yeah,
and all hell ensued. You know.
Nonetheless,
yeah,
because they were all psyched up,
good and pumped
for
up.
A fight. Yeah,
yeah,
for
you were telling me something about chairs going into a pinball machine.
Yeah, chairs into the pinball machines, into the walls, all the tables.
PA go over.
The PA probably went over. Mm-hmm. Chairs into the PA. I remember that. Mm-hmm. So, oh, thanks a lot. Yeah, there's our speakers,
yeah.
And. None of the tables ever stood properly after that night. That's why when we were looking at this with playing Larry's on the Saturday.
These posters, yeah.
And so we played the Saturday night twice. I thought, I didn't remember if we even played the Saturday night because once that ride started, that was it for the night.
How were you going to get anywhere else?
Yeah, I don't know if Sunday happened either. There was somebody almost killed in front of me at that show. A full beer bottle went into the guy's head. He went down on the floor, and three or four guys went at him with boots and chairs, and then the cops came in when the place was cleared out, and that guy was just lying there immobile for a long time. Never did hear what happened to him. But so I don't know if the Sunday of that gig happened or not. It's all hazy to me now.
Mm. Okay. Mm. I have in my notes here that you guys played a show on Friday, July 13th with Arson and with Arson at Larry's Hideaway. Was that with this lineup or was it with an earlier lineup?
That's this lineup, yeah.
Okay. Anything memorable at that show?
I don't think I've ever posted
that one. I can't say there's anything memorable about that show. But that was May as well, so it's...
Yeah, by then I think we were managed by the Garys at the Edge, and we started to play...
A lot more?
A lot, yeah.
Okay.
We did a lot of gigs, actually.
We did the Rock Palace a lot, too.
Rock Palace and the Edge we played later regularly.
Well, 2 weeks later, there's a gig with the Violetones at the Rock Palace, and this is when the Violetones had gotten a bit more rockabilly.
Yeah.
The Rock Palace, that's like the Lee's Palace, right?
Upstairs. I'm not sure it's a dance gate, but was it?
It was the upstairs part. Yeah, you had to go up the stairs, just like the Turning Point.
Was it an old Chinese restaurant at that point?
Yeah, kind
of
fancy.
You played in a Chinese. You were playing in a restaurant.
Well, yeah, but it had been designed as like a dinner club or something.
Had a
stage.
Dance
it was
floor,
a big room with this big stage and everything. But it was dining, and they did their.
It was around the edges,
traditional Chinese entertainment of some kind. But
that seems like a weird culture clash to me.
Well, Johnny Loveson kind of ran the place. It was his band played there every night almost, right?
Okay. The Next.
Yeah, Johnny Loveson, The Next.
So he kind of worked it in for everybody else.
He got Dead Boys playing there. He had.
I guess whoever had owned or managed it before had had abandoned that program or that format. So that's when Johnny came in, Johnny Loveson, and the rock band started or the punk band started playing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. In August, you played a Femme Fatale gig with 04 and Buns. Tell us about that gig.
Well, who put that on? Johnny Loveson, and he wanted to have a team of, all bands with women, and
04 was the third band,
So it's
And who were the Buns?
No idea.
I remember the Buns.
I remember seeing them. I remember what they sounded like. I remember the girl that fronted the band.
They did the demo at the same place we did in Hamilton.
Yeah,
I think because all three of us did the demo at the same place.
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
Yeah, that'd be interesting to. Working that, I don't
find
know.
Out who they
had
were,
a song, "Break Out of Your Shell." I thought was a cool song. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember that one.
And was all girls or
no? Just female singer.
Same as the rest of us.
You did a second gig with Tyranna in August 18th and 19th, with the Existers and the Curse.
That's the original band, yeah. So that's good. That's 78.
Okay, that's year before.
Earlier.
The missing link here is when the Dills gig was. I would guess that'd be July or August. I'm pretty sure it was summer.
It would still be in the summer.
And that would be when things would really heat up with the Garys, I guess.
Yeah.
Because they got, obviously they were aware of us.
Did you have those little ones there?
Yeah, I was looking through these newspaper clippings to look, see if there was the Dills gig, but it's not
Did
there.
You also play a show with the members?
The members, yeah.
At the Chelsea nightclub, maybe?
And let's see if Ron's got that in his clippings here. He does. It was, Out the Chelsea nightclub was their album, and it did quite well. And but it doesn't give the month here on the clipping, but that was the Edge, and then we played very often.
What month was that?
It doesn't say here on the ad. Yeah, I'm guessing there's the Hi-Fis playing later that. And we played with the Tarts on August 12th there too, and then August 12th. Okay, so we're in August there. That's the members' show was early August or late September.
Okay,
it unfolds. And then the Garys gave us lots of shows. We played a lot of shows with Johnny and the G-Rays. There was another international band we opened for that I can never remember who it was.
There was Willie English, maybe?
Oh, they were a local band.
They were a local
band?
Yeah, they're local. Okay, I was going to ask you about a gig that you did up near York University in North York. This seems like an odd place, and it also has a story, but there's a pub called, or a place called Queen Second City, is that right?
Yeah.
Queen City Second Stop.
Where was that?
It was right set of Tobago, Finch and Keel or something, not
somewhere
too far from York
University.
And it was just in a little industrial plaza, and it was just a bar. And
how did you get
how we
gig?
Got that? I had played there with Jasper from Battered Wives. We hadn't joined Battered Wives. This is like a full year before Tyranna, and I don't know how he must have known somebody, and it was just like. Really a weird place for us to be playing, but that we didn't.
No,
and we were just looking for when Tyranna formed. you know, there wasn't really very many places to play at that time. I think it was a little lull between, you know, Club David's had closed down and burned down, I guess. You know, there's no Crash and Burn, and I don't know what's going on in the Beverly, but we never played the Beverly Tavern. Maybe
we
it's too small. I don't know. Maybe, but there wasn't really many places. We just had to hustle gigs. That's how we ended up in Tottenham. Any connections that we had, I just called up because I'd played there before, and the guy, sure, come on up. I don't know if he paid us or anything, you know, but we just wanted to play. So,
but this show in particular had a story about borrowing a PA system, didn't it? Up at Atkinson College at York.
Oh no, that was where you're. That was the very first band. Dave Porter, the first drummer. Had some tie with Atkinson College. I don't know if it was just a friend or if he'd done classes there, but yeah, they lent us either a PV or maybe even a good old trainer column PA set, and that was just for rehearsal. But
okay, that something unrelated then. I just figured it was related because of the location.
No.
Yeah. Okay.
And but that same booker that Cleve's talking about that got us the Tottenham gig and the Queen City Second Stop, Nucci's Bar and Grill, as we called it, he got us in the Piccadilly Tube in one of our very last gigs. It would be in November after the Iggy Pop show.
November 24th.
Yeah, and this is significant because, as Ronnie mentioned earlier about being on the subway and, you know, getting attacked by people because you had hair that looked different than theirs, or it was kind of unheard of for any of the punk bands to play the Piccadilly Tube. That was the Yonge Street strip, you know, the home of Max Webster and Rush and all those bands that started.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the rock
scene. That was the enemy.
Yeah. And there was Tarana playing.
That's
to
weird.
The rock scene crowd.
That's very weird.
Yeah.
And this is somewhere around college, right? In a basement?
It wasn't near. It was on Yonge Street, but it wasn't closer to Bluer then, wasn't it?
No. It was very close to the edge. It wasn't far from the edge.
Yeah, because we went over from the edge after the New Year's Eve show.
That's where I got beat up pretty good going down those stairs.
Yeah. With the Kings, I worked with a girl who went up with one of the guys in the Kings who did quite well. And they were playing the Piccadilly Tube the night the New Year's Eve we played with Jane County. And but, yeah, it was just a completely different crowd and scene. And I think we actually went over okay at the Piccadilly Tube. But so that was
Willie English, right?
Yeah. Okay. And Willie English were probably definitely a new wave-ish kind of 60s British Invasion sound. But
so, someone was in a cast at this show.
Yeah, that was me. Yeah, I know.
What appendage was broken?
right leg, and the knee still bothers me. It just popped it at a rehearsal and was in a cast, so that was the only gig I ever stood still at.
Yeah, that's you said that was uncomfortable because you couldn't move around.
Yeah, I felt like a total lame ass standing, you know. I thought you put on a show. That was your job. You know?
Yeah, okay.
So it's significant that there was beginning to be some kind of crossover between the rock scene and the punk scene.
At least for clubs, venues, or something.
Yeah,
like that.
At least
clubs,
some booker was willing to take a shot.
Yeah.
That people were coming to the shows, you know. So.
Okay, you mentioned something about Tottenham. What was that show like? I mean, I was thinking of Tottenham. Well, my wife's from that area, and it seems still like a redneck bastion. How did you survive that show? How did that show come about?
Cleve and I got in a Dodge right away, and then Ronnie and Vera hung around.
Yeah. Well, they offered us a room
and
for
barely
the
escaped, right?
And we thought, and we went up the room, was like, oh my god, this is it? Like, it was like, it was pretty low end for a room.
Yeah.
and then these guys that were still, so we went back down for a drink. You guys had left, mm-hmm. and I think the bar was pretty much closed, but they gave us another drink, and these guys invited us to a party, and so we went. And I could tell that once we got to the party, I realized it was a mistake coming here. These guys are really rough, and I don't know how this is going to end. I just wanted to get Vera and I out of there, and they realized we were getting ready to take off. And so I went out, so I said, Vera, let's get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
And so we went out to my car, and it started. I had this old MGB, MG, whatever they call them, English little doodad. And it started, but it was revving really fast, but I just didn't care. I just backed out, got out of there, and later I found they'd taken off a couple of spark plugs. But luckily it did start and got us out of there, and we were just so glad to see that room after all.
I think
it
gig,
looked wonderful.
I think the gig itself was probably just a mistake. I don't think there was very many people there. Didn't. Get no, it all. It was uncomfortable.
Nobody got what we were trying to do.
Yeah.
It was definitely a hostile.
Guys sitting there with their motorcycle helmets on their chair and their helmet laws suck t-shirts, and directly baiting the band. I think the only song they responded to positively was, we had to play more sets than you'd play at the downtown club, so we threw in a lot more covers, and we ended up doing Needles and Pins because the Ramones had covered it, and we just got this idea we'd all trade instruments for one song.
Okay.
And Vera took my bass, and Cleve is on guitar with his left-handed SG, and so Ronnie's on the drums, and I was doing the vocals, and because they knew that song, I believe that's the only song they showed any positive
signs
response
of
for at
life.
All.
Yeah.
So that, and it was outright hostility, and we never encountered anything else like that. So that Ronnie and Vera went to the party after, we were just flabbergasted.
Yeah, it was a bad move.
Yeah.
We're an hour and a half, 2 hours out of town, so, Cleve and I had to get back. There was only the one room offered, so Cleve and I booted back to the city in his car. But
wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a different world. It was punk, was not appreciated by anybody but the Klan.
Well, everything was like that. Like, I had this fixation with razor blades, and I liked to wear the one as an earring, but I was wearing one for a while. I'd always have all these cuts on my neck, and Vera's going, "What are you doing?" I go, "Well, I like the look of the razor blade. That's why it's on some of those posters."
Yeah.
And she said, "Well, so we were out I remember sitting in that little house there in the front, and we got a rock, and we're trying to dull it so it'll stop cutting my neck when I move around.
Right.
But now you can go to Walmart and you could buy any of that shit. That stuff didn't you couldn't get that anywhere until New Rose opened up, you might be able to get something like that there.
Right.
But now you can go to it's unbelievable. You can get stuff like that everywhere.
Yeah.
It's just commonplace. It's just
it's crazy.
No one would grab a razor blade nowadays and, I'm going to use the real one. Just got to dull it down a bit.
Yeah.
That was what was really exciting about the, Cleve was there in the very earliest days, but even at the turning point when I got in and mid-'78, it was exciting to see who would show up and what.
Yeah, Mickey had the most amazing clothes. You could just study Mickey. You could see all the things he'd pin on himself, and you just ask him to be the story behind every little, from a bottle cap to, you name it, and he'd have it on him. It was
little
amazing.
Rubber fetuses.
That might have been where I got the idea, actually.
That's Mickey from the Rebels. But people would show up in a garbage bag shirt or a plastic, just formed a plastic vest, and that everybody was doing something unique to spin the fashion. It was very exciting, and there was a lot of artistry going into that and thought. And it's also cookie cutter now, and I'm in uniform. I remember feeling that with the hardcore scenes. Like, I went to the fort one time in Kensington, and here's 200 people in leather jackets with paints and studs and nails, and they all looked exactly the
Mohawks.
Same. Mohawks. And they were just exactly the same.
Yeah.
considered sponsoring your favorite CIUT show with your business? It's easy to find out how. Just contact our cheery sales staff at CIUTsales@gmail.com. That's CIUTsales@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you.
This CIUT 89.5 FM, the University of Toronto Community Radio Station, available across Canada on Star Choice National Satellite Service, channel 826, and worldwide at www.ciut.fm.
There was a gig you guys did around Labor Day weekend that Johnny Loveson organized.
Yep, the end of summer bash.
With his band The Next. Yeah, tell us about that show.
I think we were just trying to, you know, it was hard to get people at the clubs. So we thought about doing this big end of summer bash. The people, you know, the poor kids who don't get to go up to Muskoka, you know, they got to have something to do too. So we put on this six bands for $6. And there was, I actually somewhere have the...
The Forgotten Rebels.
The stage list. Yeah, we got the Forgotten Rebels.
NFG from London.
Yeah.
NFG. Which is the early 63 Monroe, right?
63, thank you, yeah. And they were awesome.
They were.
Yeah. These long hairs, like hair down to their waist kind
the
of
the cowboy
things.
Hat. It was just such an odd mixture for
cowboy
their sound. It was great.
They were like gigging the Stooges or something, I guess.
There was Power Hill?
Power Hill. I have no idea who they were.
The Watts?
The Watts were a cool mod outfit. I quite like those guys. Ben
the Basics.
Ben Wicks' son was the singer, Vince Wicks. The Basics
of the Watts.
Yeah,
of the Watts. Yeah, the Basics. I think were kind of a new wave-ish, angular arts.
Basics. Yeah, that was Fergus Hambleton who went on to the Satellites and all that. But it was a new wave kind of thing. And
so he has his roots in the punk rock scene.
Yeah, I think he played in the '60s. He's got a pretty rich history, Fergus. He does. He also worked at the Peter Pan, which is a significant kind of Queen Street little location where people gathered, you know. But and who else was on that bill?
The Fictions.
Fictions, yeah.
Yeah.
I think they put out some vinyl. I don't recall a lot about them. Mm. And that was a great party. So like it was two sets. It was an afternoon set with all the bands and then an evening set. 12 noon till 1 a.m., it says on the poster, yeah.
Okay.
I remember that being a really good time. That was again at the Rock Palace upstairs at what's Lee's Palace now. And it was a very cool club. It was a big open room, and there were booths lining both sides of the hall. And then a nice big stage and those old paper Chinese lanterns like you see in kind of upscale Chinese restaurants. A huge paper globe in the middle of the room. And it was a classy place. It's like you were...
There's a candle on every table in the booth.
Yeah.
It was
too classy for us.
It was pretty classy for what it was for the bands that played.
For the bands
that
played. Yeah, and it was trashed by the end of the room.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But it was a... You know, when you'd see, say, the Beverly Hillbillies TV show and they go down to the Whiskey-A-Go-Go and you'd see some band... That's what it felt like playing at the Rock Palace. It wasn't certainly wasn't the turning point with syringes and blood and broken glass all over the washrooms.
Yeah. Tell us about the Iggy Pop gig, November 9th and 10th. How did that come about? Was that a Gary's?
Oh, yeah, it was a Gary show, and so the G-Waves were on the bill. I remember, I think...
Was that the one where David Bowie was playing with Iggy Pop?
No,
it was he had a Cracker Jack band, but it was who was it? Glenn Matlock was from the Pistols was on bass.
Yeah.
Brian James from the Damned was on guitar.
Yeah. Tangerine Dream on drums.
Ivan Kral, was he Tangerine Dream or Patti Smith?
Yeah.
Where was this gig at?
Was at the Music Hall on the Danforth.
Okay.
Yeah. Two nights
and
sold out.
I think it was probably our finest moment. We played.
He was kind of promoting New Values at the time, it wasn't the same band from the record. And he had a little bit of the new rock. He did Dog Food. Like, he was just getting into the next.
Yeah, but the band was great.
They were great.
Tyranna, I think, we probably played our best ever. That's what I remember. Yeah. It was really
best
exciting, and it was a full house, and we were at our peak, kind of, I think.
Yeah.
And totally memorable night for us. And I remember Wilder Penfield, who wrote chose it as one of the top shows of the year.
Yeah, he listed it in his top 10 concerts of the year, and he mentioned it was because of the opening. He didn't mention us by name, but he said the high rating was because of the opening acts.
I remember you telling me about this, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, as Cleve said, we totally rehearsed for that gig, and as Ronnie just mentioned, the sound is significant, because when we
it's
were
first
on stage,
time we could hear each other.
Yeah, it was like being was on that stage was like hearing a record of your band for the first time. Yeah. Like,
well, it was a music hall.
Yeah.
So you'd think that they had the sound down.
Proper monitors, and you could actually hear, and we rehearsed for it, we were tight. Yeah, and we were pumped to be playing with these people.
And we liked being on stage, and we put a, it was like a show, you know.
And it was a huge stage. It was the biggest one we'd ever played on.
Yeah,
that's
and
for
we
sure.
worked it. Vera worked it. She was right up in the front row, leaning down, talking to people in the crowd, getting photographs. People were handing her like Polaroids, and we all did our part working the stage.
And we looked good.
We looked really good. And then the second night, the first night was kind of was a little damper because it was pouring rain and people were out in the rain. So when we were the first band on, and they'd just been soaked, so they were kind of just getting used to it. But the second night, we came on and were really powerhouse and got a strong encore.
There was two nights?
Two nights. Friday and Saturday. And the Saturday night, we did our set. An encore was called for. They sent us back out to do it, which, you know, just thrilled us, of course. And then Johnny G Rays came on and didn't get an encore, which thrilled us even more. We were downstage celebrating with our case of beer, like, wow, we got a case of beer and a dressing room. We had a dressing room.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
I had one picture here
of Viggy I took from the side of the stage of that show.
With Glenn Matlock there.
Yeah, there it is, with a terrible camera I had at the time.
It was a total thrill to be doing that gig. Remember we were up in the office at the Edge when the Gary's asked us if we wanted to play it, and I just, you know, my jaw hit the floor, you know.
Yeah.
And I'd been in a band a year and a half, and here I am talking to Glenn Matlock. We're both holding our basses on stage and talking to this guy who wrote Anarchy in the UK, the song that started it all for me. I was losing it, but I never mentioned the Sex Pistols, just talked about his new band.
Yeah,
it was a great thing, and then it all went
proper musical protocol.
Yeah.
Okay.
Ron was sitting with Brian James down in the audience.
That's weird, eh?
While we're doing sound check.
It was interesting. Though I got in trouble.
You got in trouble for
in Revenge. The first night I did Revenge, well, I had this thing. The song Revenge has this middle part where it kind of dies out, and I grab a beer and I down it. And then I do a slide thing with it, and then it goes quiet, and the song starts again. But we didn't do that song in soundcheck, and I hadn't been told, as I was told later, Mr. Pop likes a dry floor.
Sure.
And, of course, I drank the beer. Most of it went all over me. Did my slide thing, and it was after the first night, and I was told by the Edge staff, Mr. Pop likes a dry floor. You just made it all wet. He won't be able to slide in that area. Don't do that tomorrow night. That's okay.
Oh, yeah.
So the next night, I had an empty beer bottle. And I just used it.
Punk rock.
Got to keep everyone happy.
Yeah.
Iggy said hi, though, so that was...
Yeah,
that
was nice. He was very pleasant.
Teenage Head showed up. I just flipped a picture of them in the scrapbook here. But, yeah, Teenage Head all filed down, and we're standing there as, you know, the primo band of the day. We're all leaning up on the hall of the music hall waiting to go in to see Iggy, and... Remember, I went up and said hi to Nikki, and he kind of... They weren't there in time to see us. They probably had no idea that I was in a band, and he kind of brushed me off. And then when I was heading backstage before Iggy set, they were all lined up to get in, and I kind of looked him in the eye and waltzed by, and that felt pretty good. Cause,
yeah.
You know.
I getting snubbed like
still
that.
Loved those guys. I wanted them to know, you know, I'm playing here with Iggy, man.
Yeah.
And they did go in and meet him, so that was great that they had got to meet Iggy Pop.
Yeah, for sure.
Never thought of
Tell us about, there was a gig that you did on December 31st that we've mentioned at the Edge with Jane County. Tell us about that gig.
Well, the Garys had booked Jane County in for, the day before New Year's and New Year's Eve. And the idea is they were going to record a live album, and the kind of angle was it was going to be the first album ever recorded in the 80s. You know, we were also kind of
so it was like
era conscious and all that, you know, that we were kind of moving into in the next decade and all that. So we were asked to do the opening slot for that.
And this be the last Tyranna show, the last Tyranna gig?
Shows. It's four or five nights.
Yeah. Okay. Now, did you guys get an opportunity to record as well with this?
Yeah, there's a story to that. Was after we played the first night, the company that recorded Jane County offered us to record the next night. And we were fine with that, except the fact that we went to Piccadilly Tube the night before, and I got beat up pretty bad. But I could still play. My fingers were all fine. So we showed up there, but it turns out we're going to go on after Jane County. She was holding me around. She was going to leave. And so she left, but she also took all the microphones.
Right.
And
all the good microphones, right?
The good recording microphones. So the Edge used their own microphones, the goodness of their heart. And unfortunately, they're just standard Shure mics, and they just bled all over the place. So the recording was apparently really poor. Mm. And so it wasn't used.
Right. Okay. But unfortunately, thanks to Jane Kenny.
Yeah, thanks, Jane.
There's some scene camaraderie, eh? Tell me about the one song I think that did get released sort of around the Tyranna period was a song called Back Off Baby on the No Pedestrian Comp. Tell us about that song. Where was it recorded? What's the song about? How did the compilation come about? I'm curious to know.
Well, there's this guy, Tom Adam had Cottingham Sound, which wasn't that many recording studios, I don't think, around at the time. And he was, pretty street level and inexpensive. So he was in touch with and, connected with all of the street-level bands and a supporter of the punk rock scene. So he had decided he was going to choose a song for a bunch of different bands and put them together on a compilation. So Tyranna was asked, and we had given him some demos, I think, that we'd done, or he chose Back Off Baby to go on it.
Cleve's song.
Yeah. That's the song that Cleve wrote.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yes. Yeah, I wrote that.
Did you get to play on it?
Yeah. I played the drums on that.
Okay. I wanted to ask you a bit about some recordings that you'd done. Can you tell me about... you mentioned first that within 2 weeks you had done a recording at a place called Wade Avenue's Artist Collective.
Yeah, it was... That was
John Tucker had a four-track studio or something?
Yeah, the original band. He had his own four-track, and it wasn't a Fostex. It was a high-end four-track, which was... very rare. I can't tell you the name of it, but that was a whole artist collective. Robbie Rocks lived there. There were maybe some other bands, photographers, painters. It's very, very cool scene there. That was where the first demo was done, and then the second demo with the four-piece, and then the five-song demo we all did here was at the Basement Studios in Hamilton that Mickey DeSadist introduced us to.
Okay, So there was a demo that was recorded in the early days, and there was a demo recorded in August.
Yeah.
That was another demo that was you did Test Tube Babies and Toronto Boys there. And that was without John Ziegler.
Yeah.
And then Cleve joined in December. You did the recording in summer of 79 in Hamilton, that Hamilton studio.
Yeah. Do you remember what month that was?
I don't remember what month, but I think
it was the three summer. Of us here with rabies.
Yeah. And Mickey played a part in this, right?
As well as
founding the studio for
you. He was hanging out in the studio with us. He lived nearby, and he just did some background vocals on...
Neighbor.
My Neighbor?
My Neighbor, yeah.
Okay. And then the live recording at the Edge?
Yeah.
Yeah, there's not too much documentation, I guess, of the band.
Discovered in the last couple of weeks another tape that I think is from that Nucci's Bar and Grill North York show. And unlike the other one we had, which from Nucci's wasn't anything you'd want to broadcast, really badly recorded. But there's this one tape that, for being taped on a cassette on a live stage, it sounds pretty damn good, and we're smoking. Mm. I was amazed at how hot we were in this recording. I was just, I never remembered. Didn't even know it existed, and then I just found it the other day. So we may try to get that to see the light of day.
Okay. And do you know which recording session the Back Off Baby came out was done in?
What session? What month? You know, it's done at Cottingham Sound, and we just did the one song.
You just did one song?
Just did the one song for the album. Yeah.
Okay. So you only recorded one song at that session?
At that session, yeah.
So it was either December or January, because as soon as as I found out I hadn't been invited to the recording and it had happened that I was out of the band, I quit. So.
Yeah. Okay. So did that lead to the breakup then?
Yeah, that led to the breakup.
Yeah,
I left soon after.
Okay.
Soon after. I wasn't very happy about Jer not being on that.
And
or, you know, yeah, Vera had asked Scream and Sam Ferreira, who had been in the Ugly and the Vile Tones, to do that. And I played a lot with Sam, and he's a good buddy of mine now.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the right, you know, I didn't think it was the right thing to have him play on that song.
No, it wasn't his style either. It was at all.
No hard feelings against Sam on it, though.
No, no.
Yeah.
He's a sweetheart.
It didn't represent the band well. I think we all agreed it wasn't the sound of the band. It wasn't a very good
as the only thing that got released by Tyranna.
Yeah,
it wasn't an accurate reflection.
And as a songwriter, I mean, I was a drummer, but I played guitar. I'd written lots and lots of songs, and I was interested in, kind of playing a certain style of song. And I want it to be the eighth note thing and stay one chord for a long time and all that, and have it a little bit different, be it as simple and really accessible, but have a just a little twist on it. So, I mean, stylistically, I had something in mind, and Jer was doing the job on that. So, you know, yeah. So we never actually, we do have a version that's on our little EP that we've recently put out.
That's the
Johnny Bubblegum plays. So that's more indicative, I think, of the song and of Tyranna than that No Pedestrians.
Okay, how did the EP come about?
Well, just to finish with No Pedestrians, sure. Shades Magazine, which was the journal put out by the existers of the day, when they reviewed the No Pedestrians record, they singled out Tyranna and 04 as the best cuts on the on the record, but they themselves said that somebody should release the original Tyranna demos because this one wasn't really indicative of the band.
Mm-hmm.
And but then, so 30 years go by, and I'm hanging out at Mitzi's sister playing with Sad Ocean Space Bear one night, and Fred Robinson from UIC introduces me to this guy who's talking about starting a record label, and I was playing in Sad Ocean Space Bear at the time, so I was trying to get it for them, and he says, well, you know, I don't really understand that it's this new stuff. I want to do some vintage punk rock. So Don Paul with him, he says, well, why don't you do Tyranna? And that's how the beginning of the EP came together. And then it took maybe a year to come out, but it came out in 78, 30th anniversary of punk rock and Tyranna. And though that demo was recorded in 79, but we got a track from the very first one-week-old band demo, and then several tracks from the Hamilton demo, and it was pretty spoken. It was well received. Maximum Rock and Roll gave us a very strong review, and many of the editors singled it out as the top song that came into the magazine of the month. And then a guy over in England wrote me wanting to get a signed copy of the record, and he was really excited about the record and said, well, you know, you should get some more of the stuff out there. So he put me in touch with Rave Up Records. This is Dave Disaster over in England. Thanks, Dave. And he took it on himself to send some songs over to Rave Up in Italy. And Pierre at Rave Up immediately said, yeah, I want to do you guys. And we'll have a full LP coming out this September with Don Pyle's photographs and Don's design, the cover.
Wow. Yeah. That'll be great.
That's
amazing news.
Yeah, it's looking great.
So what will appear on, is this the rest of the recordings that will come out?
I believe it's going to be the complete studio recordings, then leaving some room for, we have to make a final decision on that, but I think that's what Pierre at Rave Up wants to do, and then, you know, maybe leaves the door open for a live EP if we can get somebody to do that, because
there's some of that still there.
Yeah, there is some good recordings now.
Amazing. This is great news.
And thank you for Equalizing Distort for having us on here and recording us in live.
Oh, don't thank me. That was amazing. And I was listening to that last night. I was just going, man, this is just incredible.
CIUT 89.5 FM, the University of Toronto Community Radio Station. Available across Canada on Star Choice National Satellite Service, Channel 826, and broadcasting worldwide at www.ciut.fm.
I did want to ask you a bit about some of the songs. Do you know some of the ideas behind the songs? That you did a song called Johnny, which appeared on the EP, and a couple of you were named Johnny in the band, right?
Yeah, in the very first.
Is there a story
band,
behind the song?
Yes and no. This was again the band was only several days old when we did those gigs. We all called ourselves. We did have two legitimate Johns in the band, and I called myself Johnny Bubblegum. And so we called the drummer Johnny as well. Just Vera was very much into confronting the audience,
yeah,
and being a provocateur. And so this was, she was kind of, I always felt she was kind of going tongue in cheek at the whole Johnny culture, and
yeah, right,
just try to find some way to provoke an audience, because the famously bored Toronto audiences that don't respond, Vera was trying to get some action happening between the band and the crowd, and
yeah,
it did work. And so that was, I always felt that was part of that song, the lyrics of it. It was my the tune was mostly mine, and Beer did the lyrics on that. But Shockface was another kind of confrontational song. Beer's looking at street culture and bums on the street and people going downhill in their lives, and just saying she wanted no part of that. And
yeah, I think it ends Kill the Human Race.
Really?
Shockface, Kill the Human Race. Is that right?
Shock the race.
Shock the race.
Wouldn't surprise.
Shock the race.
Sorry, I opened it then like that.
Vera, yeah, she could. Vera was an outstanding woman. Very interested in all kinds of like the paranormal and alternate. I never heard anything kind of about alternate medicine, alternate healing, alternate food ideas. Mm. Like, and Vera was into all this stuff way before anybody I ever heard of.
Yeah.
And that kind of insight went into her lyrics.
There were some good critiques too of like the the straight people beside, like, that live beside you. Like, there's a song called My Neighbor, which sounded like it was in tongue in cheek, making it sounded like she was singing about my neighbor has all these great things, but you know, really, who cares about driving these fancy cars and things like that? Is that accurate?
You know, I don't know. She would just come up with lyrics, and
there was a song called "Dying in the Suburbs." It makes me think of the same theme.
That was Cleves.
Yeah.
But
I don't know where she came up with her lyrics. It was just, like I said, at least with myself, I would just be making noise with the guitar. She'd say, "Keep that," and she'd come in with her lyrics and start going to work with this and tape it. And I don't think she didn't put any deep thought in putting it together with the music, but with her lyrics. The more songs she wrote, the more she started writing about the environment and space. And like, she started with like really street level songs,
mm-hmm.
and by the end, she was. If you read some of her lyrics, like actually when Cleve and Jerry weren't around anymore, they were just all about like the future and space, and like she just changed her direction.
There
started getting more.
Are those songs like Test Tube Babies?
Global Conscious. No, that's an older one as well.
That goes back to 78.
Sex Ray Eyes, maybe?
No, there's a lot of songs that you're probably not aware of.
Okay.
Because we didn't record them in any studios or anything. And but a lot of them were about space and like cancer and like the environment, what it's doing to us. Like things that are big nowadays.
Yeah.
She was just starting to starting to weigh heavily on her mind.
Yeah.
And she was starting to write more and more about that.
Well, that's unfortunate that they never got recorded.
Yeah.
Live recordings. Subway was a song where she's, if I'm gleaning it properly, she seemed to be using the subway as a metaphor for going between different states of consciousness or different ideas of how you could lead your life. And after Cleve and I left the band, they did a couple more gigs, and it was Tirana then, Terrana.
Yeah, and she went.
I saw a poster like that. Yeah, so the name changed because of
the UFO on it. Like that was
flying.
That was that period.
That was like the way she was. Like her mind was going in that direction when things just kind of.
But another important element with Vera is like if you look at look at Johnny, there's a na 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 in there, and I think it's in Divorce she uses did not did too. Like she could bring these child world elements in and these playful elements, and. Definitely not going to be pigeonholed into this is punk, this is a tough woman, a tough dominant woman can't act like a child. Like
right.
Nobody told Vera what to do, and she'd find her own ideas.
Staring at the wall. You can wait at home for your boyfriend to call. You can spend all night staring at the tube, but you ain't seen nothing, just staring all through. Well, I don't mind you wasting your time. It's okay, you ain't wasting mine. gotta get up and get around. Gotta get up and go downtown. Cause you're dying in the suburbs, dying in the suburbs, dying in the suburbs, nothing to do. Dying in the suburbs, dying in the suburbs, you're gonna do nothing. The whole life will. Never leave your neighborhood. You be a good girl like a Tony should. You said Six is your favorite group. So don't play them for me, cause they make me cute. Cause you're dying in the suburbs, dying in the suburbs, dying in the suburbs, nothing to do. Dying in the suburbs, dying in the suburbs, you're gonna be nothing your whole life through. You're dying in the suburbs, dying in the suburbs, dying in the suburbs, nothing to do. Dying in the suburbs, dying in the suburbs, yeah, you're just dying in the suburbs, dying in the suburbs, dying in the suburbs, nothing to do. Dying in the suburbs, dying in the suburbs, you're gonna be nothing. Your whole life you. Are you gonna be nothing? Your whole life you.
Okay. I wanted to, you did a show last year with Zoe from the Bayonets filling in.
Yep. The record release.
Yeah. But Vera was noticeably absent. What happened to her?
Vera's got some health issues. She's still around. She's alive. She's in the city. But, she didn't want to take part in the live gig. She hasn't sung in a long time. I think she gave up on music after the Tirana band with Ron, so she didn't feel she wanted to be involved, and she's aware of the record. I think pretty proud of it, but
yeah,
she
should be.
Didn't want to go back.
Okay, there was I wanted to ask you a bit about some press that you might have got back in the day. You mentioned the Shades review.
Yeah, the Shades review.
We mentioned the MRR review recently. But there was a review, I think, you talked about in The Sun for the Iggy Pop gig.
The Wilder Fenn Panfield review. Other than that...
I saw a Jonathan Gross write-up with pictures and stuff.
Yeah, that was another Toronto Sun article. He was a writer with the Toronto Sun, interested in the music scene. He did an article on musicians and their day jobs. And he put a picture of Cleveland in his postie outfit. And I was...
You were behind.
Yeah, I was just hanging around that day. So
was Vera at the bottom?
Too. No, it was just
somebody else. Okay.
That was the same weekend. That was the days of the Nucci, the week of the Nucci's Bar and Grill.
Oh, was it?
Dates up north. So I was crashing it at Cleve's house that week. That's why I just happened to be there.
Okay.
And there was the new music show in Toronto on City TV. The beginnings of that was a print journal that they actually sent out. You could just subscribe and get free copies sent out. And they did an article on Stephen Davey of The Dishes wrote the article. And it was a survey of the top bands, and then in the end, this very final paragraph, he talked about watching out for new bands coming up, and he mentioned us in that. But that was it for press. There were maybe two or three street-level fanzines. Johnny Garbage Can had his T.O. Punk in probably 77 or 76. But there was very little press. No airplay. You didn't even have college radio at that time. Mm. Ryerson maybe broadcast to its own campus.
But so, it was an internal license.
But there was nothing. There was no support at all.
Yeah.
So no press, no airplay. It was just what happened.
But it was
on
pretty common amongst the whole scene.
Yeah. And, people say, Tirana didn't even release anything outside of the song. Well, we turned down a record contract Minglin because we were going to get ripped off, and it was proven true that we would have gotten seriously ripped off, though we would have had a single in England. And I think we were holding out for, with the Iggy Pop show happened, we got the review in the paper, managers were starting to come around and looking at us. We were holding out for a good release that hopefully would have taken us somewhere. So it's not as if we just couldn't get it together. There was lots of bands who, whoever managed to put out a single. And, a lot of those singles, I don't think don't stand up, and I don't think they'll hold up historically. And I think the Tirana recordings stand for themselves in that we didn't release something at the time. I don't really think matters. We were just waiting for the right release and
yeah,
wanting to re-record in a proper studio, I guess. And unfortunately, it didn't happen until now, but the recordings are still
there.
But it's
had an impact. I mean, and, you know, now people are, there's a lot of punk rock archaeology going on where people are finding these bands like Tirana.
Yep.
And it's had an impact, I think.
Yeah, Rave Up has had about like 80 releases.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, Lenny K did with the Nuggets collection. People are going back and pulling out all the things that were recorded, whether they were, I guess with Nuggets, they were actual releases. But when you survey all the actual recorded sounds and take a look at who is playing the new punk rock and who is playing warmed over rock and roll, I think Tirana's place in the... in the history of Toronto, we'll find its right level.
Okay.
In time.
I hope so. Well, thanks very much for taking the time out today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Test you babies. Yeah. called Jealousy.
You
Thank you very much, Rotorana.